Berlin, and the telephone and tube plant there. And I used to carry all the new tube types down to Heidelberg for various scientific testing and things of this kind. And I have been extracting out one or two of each batch, and I have them stashed away. I said, "Well, there must be some catch to this. What do you want now for it?" And he said, "A very simple thing. My wife is pregnant, and I would like, and she's about to deliver, and I'd like to have permission for a midwife to come out during the curfew hours in case she's needed by my wife urgently." And I checked with the Army and found this was quite easy to do, so I produced the pass and picked up immediately about 40 or 50 latest model little magnetron, which were sent on through. Now, this is sort of typical. No, the troops in that area had no special knowledge or information about what it was all about.
Your job really is to try to get at these targets and work with the troops.
Right.
I guess you had to work with G2 pretty...
Mostly with the G2 job. So after doing what we could do in that general area, we returned to London to try to write things up a bit and get a rest and some clean clothes. I was in London just before VE Day, during the time when I'd been working in Heidelberg, the troops had progressed and the war was almost over. I was probably must have returned to London about a week before VE Day and was in London on VE Day. And either the day after VE Day or the second day after it, in any case, where I was sent again with the CIOS team urgently to Garmisch-Partenkirchen, on a team headed by Jack O'Mara, and he had asked this time that I be named as his deputy leader. And our job there was specifically to follow up on the Peenemünde scientists under Dornberger and von Braun and Exter, who had been, quote, captured, unquote, by the 10th Army. The story seems to be quite clear that they had deliberately turned themselves over to the 10th Army, feeling that this was the best situation for them under the circumstances. By the time I got there, they were, all the people in that area from Peenemünde had been collected together in one great hotel, tourist hotel type of installation, and were available for interrogation, and so we did begin to do the interrogation. The members of our team varied from time to time. Different people would come. Some people would come, some would go. It was a sort of a loose arrangement. We had taken over another small tourist house there, sort of a Gasthaus arrangement of three or four floors, and O'Mara had managed to liberate a couple of Romanian PW men as cooks, and some girls from one of the Iron Curtain countries just to clean the house and so on. We were not permitted, by the way, to use German people as help in any of our facilities. Another difference between ourselves and the Navy. Navy did use German people, and much more effective because they could talk with them better. In any case, we were running this sort of hotel, and a number of fairly distinguished people did come through at one time or another. But mostly, my work was every day trying to talk to the Germans. Our ability to do this fluctuated from day to day, depending to a certain extent on what the Germans themselves had decided, and to some extent on how the 10th Army troops who were guarding them were treating them. I have to, of course, admit that that treatment wasn't uniformly good. The troops were sort of at loose ends, having won the war in that area and having not too much to do, and still regarding the Germans as being the enemy and subject to anything they wanted to do to them. I remember one day when von Braun told me that one of the troops had simply demanded and taken his father's watch, which he was carrying, and tires on the bicycles, which they had stashed in the courtyard there, were slashed, and sometimes the food was enough and available, sometimes it wasn't. And so all of this sort of thing was just an impediment to my basic progress, which is trying to find out what these people knew and what they would tell me. So frequently I had to interrupt the interrogation to go down and negotiate with the 10th Army and try to get better treatment for my my subjects. But we were there quite a long time, several months altogether, and in general working every day.
What happened to your reports that you made?
These reports were filed. We kept a large file. All the team members were supposed to turn in all their reports and all the information which they had and keep them in a central file. The information was still there when I left, as I'll tell you in a few minutes, on special orders from the Army. They were still there. In Garmisch-Partenkirchen. I'm sure that the intention was, and I suspect what actually happened was, that all those reports were sent back through the normal CIOS channels, which was via London, to the Air Force Technical Document Center in Dayton, at Wright Field. So I would presume that if they still exist, they would now be at Wright-Patterson. Some of them were subtracted unofficially and without permission by Professor Zwicky, who left without notice during the middle of some of this interrogation and taking some of their other valuable file material with him. Most of it could be recovered or redone, but this was... if there are some valuable things missing from that particular series, then I would see Professor Zwicky.
How about Clark Millikan?
Clark Millikan came through a few times. He was not there regularly. We did see him there on occasion. I might also add that toward the beginning of that period, we were told that there were some 13 small German freight cars full of documentation and instrumentation, material of various sorts, which had been put together very hastily by the group in the Nordhausen area before they came down to Bavaria. They had simply packed up what they could, simply thrown them into the freight cars and gotten them down to Bavaria somehow or other. Almost all of this equipment was from the guidance and control section. So part of the task we had to do right away was to unpack these 13 cars, which had never been unpacked since they left Nordhausen. So we got a crew of people down there that would know something about what was there and simply tried to sort out all this junk in 13 cars, and that was quite a task, as you can imagine. There were laboratory notebooks and textbooks and documentation of various sorts and laboratory equipment, standard test equipment, so much of it, but also some special test equipment and some pieces of hardware, experimental hardware. And that was a task. Much of it was boxed up and sent back again. Everything for the CIOS team had to go back through the standard channel to England and ultimately probably to Wright Field. We were informed that a good deal of it actually never, anything really very interesting didn't get immediately through the screen in England. It was held up there and sort of mysteriously disappeared.
So presumably a lot of interesting things.
I suspect they either are there or have been destroyed or thrown away by now. While we were sort of in the middle of this interrogation there, von Braun and Dornberger approached me and said they wanted to talk about the possibilities of working in the United States. And at that point, of course, I had no possibility whatever of making any official offers. I had no authority to even negotiate with them on that subject. But I had, must confess, that I myself had been thinking about this prior to that time, and it seemed like a very desirable idea to me. And so I did, through the poor communication system we had, try to get this idea back to Paris to the Army Ordnance people there. The thought was, I never had very good communication with them. The best we could do was telegraph. There was no telephone service there, and the telegrams were generally garbled pretty badly. But at least I got the impression they were seriously thinking about it, and that's about all I could...
Who were you dealing with in practice?
Here again, I don't remember. It was not Tough Toy. It was the man who later became chief of ordnance, Simons.
Simons.
Simons. Leslie Simons. He had come over and was at that time he was chief of Aberdeen, I believe, chief of the Aberdeen Proving Ground. He was there, and I was primarily dealing with him. I guess Hamill. So I didn't, of course, make any particular deal with the Germans, but told them I would do my best to try to see to it that the idea was carefully considered. And again, that became one of the things that was, on the days when they felt this was a good probability, they were much more eager to talk to us than on other days when they felt they'd better just shut up and keep what they had and use it as a bargaining tool. But on the whole, our relations were always very good during this period. We really didn't have any
trouble. Were you talking about Brown and Dornberger?
No, I was talking with... of course, they were the people I went to with any policy question, or Axter. I was there for such a long time that I must have talked with at least 100 people in some detail, and there were other people with me talking to them, and we were comparing notes at night.
What were your impressions of these people
on
that day?
I thought very highly of them. I felt they were... important resource. They certainly knew what they were doing, and they had accomplished a great deal. And the people that we were seeing, of course...
What were their attitudes? How did you find it? Just the personal thing?
Varied a great deal from one to another and from day to day with a given person. Some of them were very friendly and eager to talk. Others were sort of sullen and didn't want to talk at all. And we had to try to think of right keywords to elicit any sort of information, but and others would talk very nicely on one day and not on others. By being patient and not in too much of a hurry and not too arrogant about the whole bit, we were able to piece together a good deal of that.
What did they tend to do during the day, other than they were interrogated?
Well, this, of course, was one of their problems. They didn't really have anything much to do. Some of them continued to try to do a little work. Others simply, mostly, I think, they sat out and sunbathed.
Mm-hmm. And you had none of the documentation yet?
No, I had the documentation out of these 13 cars, for one thing.
You used to work with and opened up?
I did.
So you could talk to them with the documentation?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I thought it was still packed, though.
I'm not sure we... No, it wasn't packed. It was... We had it in rooms in this hotel. If I knew what to look for, I could... Right. But it was by no means complete. Remember, this was had been thrown in haste in a few hours into the cars.
Right.
But for what it was worth, yes. They had some documentation they'd brought in their briefcases, and we had ability to copy that. And so I think we were going along pretty well. And I was sort of looking forward to making up a complete and proper type report on the whole mission. And then one day I got a telegram from Paris, and utterly unable to read it. It was so badly garbled. And finally simply set it aside because there was no point in worrying about it if I didn't know what it meant. About 2 days later... Army Field Forces Lieutenant Colonel, whose name I gave you last time, what was it? I can't remember.
Williams,
yes. Lieutenant Colonel Williams showed up in Garmisch and asked me if I was ready to go. And not knowing what he had in mind at all, I asked him what he was talking about, and he showed me the original of this telegram, which was in fact an order for me to decide which Germans should come to work in a project not specified in the United States and to evacuate their wives and families out of the area around Nordhausen prior to the deadline for the Russians moving in, the Russians taking over. And that deadline at that point in time was only about 2 days away. And so at that point, it seemed quite clear that we could by no means decide who should work on a project when we didn't really even have any idea what the project should be. And to make such decisions thoughtfully and carefully was just out of the question in the time of Elmo, and we thought we had better do rather than think at that stage. So we got Von Braun and all of the people who had reported to the top echelon. In other words, we got the first echelon below the management echelon people together in jeeps and went quickly to Munich, where Colonel Williams had a Dakota airplane waiting, and put him on board the airplane and took off for Nordhausen. We were meeting and planning and working as hard as we could in the airplane all the way down, and when we got there, we had a plan ready to go for evacuating people. The idea was to evacuate as many as we could of all the people, all the Panamunda people and their families from that area. And this was a pretty sizable number. I think we had probably, there were some 600 or 700 that we would have liked to have named on the list that we'd like to get out. We did end up, finally, to make a long story short, with about 500 that went out by rail. The rest of them, there were a few who didn't want to come because they were old and they were tired of running and they just didn't want to go anymore. There were a few whose sympathies were perhaps the other direction politically and wanted to stay, and there were some that we just couldn't find. But considering the time, I think we did pretty well to get that list.
Is this your only trip to Nordhausen?
That was my only visit to Nordhausen.
Well, I got a little bit confused then about these documents. That was a separate trip that you ordered made to get five boxes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I went back in. I did go back in there. Yes, you're quite right. I did have a second very, very brief trip.
Okay, well, we'll come back later.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You know, actually, some of my other team people, including Hull and Norris particularly, and Lee Posky for a little while, and I think even House for a time, had been on, not as part of a CIOS operation, but as Ordnance Technical Intelligence people in the Nordhausen area, and had dug up very large volumes of documents from wells and so on, where the Germans had told them that they
these
had been buried.
These you had access to down in...
These eventually were all shipped back to No, we never had those in Garmisch.
The documentation, let me just backtrack, sir. The documentation that you did have in Garmisch, where did that come from?
This was equipment which had been thrown into freight cars by the Germans themselves when they went down to Bavaria.
When they moved to Bavaria. And then the rest of the documentation and items...
Much of it was buried, yeah.
Buried, right.
Actually, I think only the...
That's the story that
only the guidance and control people were able to get any of the any of their papers into freight cars even. The rest of it was pretty well buried.
But these five boxes...
That's later.
Yeah, that's later.
That's all later. Right. There were many more than five boxes. There were complete drawings and specifications and everything else for the V2 were available and had already been gotten by this crew. And by the way, Staver was in charge of that work down at Nordhausen. He himself came over at that time, and our people who were there had been working directly under him.
Right.
So they had done a yeoman job of already of getting all this documentation there. Staver was there when I got there. And together we simply called all the military operations we could find in that area and asked for vehicles. One kind or another, anything that would roll, and sent each one out with one German that was locally there who would be known to the Panamunda people with the instructions that they had about 15 minutes to pack up some personal things and come. We didn't know where we were going to take them. We hadn't been told, and only that they were going to be taken out of the area to be occupied by the Soviets and into the area that was occupied by the Americans. And that if they wanted to come, this was their only chance. And most of them came. And we assembled them then one morning, not in Nordhausen, but in, I think it was East Bleicherode, a little town outside Nordhausen, and put them in freight cars. That was all we had that would roll. And just before we took the trains out of the station, we were given the two destinations. We had thought it would be one, but we were given two destinations and told to go first to one and made half of them there and then did the second one. I might add also that the night, very late, the night before we pulled them out, I did go to the British. It was officially British territory, I might add, British occupied zone. Told them they ought to blow up the underground plant there before they pulled out. And they said, nothing doing. We don't want to get into any conflict with our friends, the Russians. But if you want to do it, we'll turn our backs. And I have always regretted that I didn't do it at the time. But
you had the
conservative we could easily have gotten it. We could easily have gotten it, getting somebody to do it. But as a civilian in an assimilated rank, working for a corporation, and being pretty young at the time, too, I plain didn't have the guts to do it either.
So you left everything intact.
Left everything intact. Except what Hamill had already pulled out in the way of equipment, which was much, of course.
Okay.
It seems to me, although at the thinking back, I don't wonder how I ever found the time, but it seems to me that it was at that point that I did go for a few hours with Seifert and Dr. Seifert of Caltech and some other people to the test area, the area where the rocket engines had been tested. And again, the question of what we should do with it. That was intact, and in fact, they ran an engine for us there. I saw a V-2 engine actually tested, static tested at the site. They did it for us. And the question was, what should we do with it? It would have been very easy to destroy that, too, to blow it up. But again, everybody was really concerned about the relationships with the Soviets. And we finally decided that we really couldn't do anything so obvious as destroying the place completely. We did, however, take out the specialized valves, which we felt would delay them the longest getting back into operation again. We took out some of the critical valves, which we could make a valid claim on for intelligence reasons. Our only right, our only authority, was to take material for intelligence interest, not to do anything else. So we had no authority, whatever, any of us, to blow things. But it was clear to us that it should have been, and I always regret that I just simply didn't do it. Had I been 10 years older, I would have done it. So the comment, naivete, is well put.
How would you have gotten along the Coast Bar after that?
I don't know, but I would have done it anyway. We did get the people on the train. It was by then already some 24 hours. I think it took us about 3 days to do it. It was already some 24 hours after the Russians were supposed to have been in there, and that they weren't. We know that they knew what we were doing. We didn't know what they would do about it, and apparently it took them long enough to use their authority. They, in the same way, should have stopped us, by all means.
Yeah.
They had every legal right to do so. But apparently they had the same kind of they had the same kind of concerns that we had about this future relationship. Well, they were in. There were some of them in Nordhausen.
Why are you doing this?
Yeah.
Well, what level?
Some people.
Troops?
No, officers.
Officers. Maybe they're milling around or watching what you're doing.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And
did you talk to any of them?
No, I didn't. But Staver had, I'm sure, and other people in the mission there knew them fairly well.
How long have they been there?
They had been there as liaison people, you see. They were not.
They didn't come in with the troops.
They didn't come in with the troops, no.
How far was the actual front of the Russian army at that time?
It must have been several hundred kilometers, anyway.
No, they were a good way away.
A good way away.
But these fellows did watch Hamill move his V-2s out?
I wasn't there when Hamill pulled the V-2s out. Yeah. That was before I got there.
Yeah. The V-2s were gone.
The V-2s were gone when I got there. That operation was complete.
Right.
So,
Well, there must have been V-2 parts still around.
Oh, yeah.
According to Art Rudolph, they said they had up to 13,000 tanks.
Oh, yeah.
But they didn't have bolts.
There were parts all over the place.
Yeah.
No question about it. And Hamill had simply taken out what he thought was enough to build about 100 parts. And he didn't have any parts list with him when he did this operation. All the parts lists were available other places. But there was just no time.
I'll have to talk to him on detail.
But he did a fabulous job, considering that he had really no good parts list there. But in some things he had very few, presumably because they just didn't have them in the factory. They may have been short. Other parts he had ample quantity. Fortunately, there are things that would have been hardest for us to redo. He did have enough.
The stories I get on the other side of the fact that he knew how they had to try to get these parts, keep that production open.
Yeah, I've heard many of these stories. So we were very eager at that point. Had only one thought in mind, and that was to get those people out of there before the Russians told us we couldn't. And I was just frantic to get that whole operation moving. And I do remember that we walked down the train that morning with, in the early morning hours, like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, with Axter and von Braun. The two personally were looking in each of the cars to see how many people they recognized, or rather how many they didn't recognize, because we thought we had a good many ringers coming along for what reason we didn't know. And we did find a few, but most of them were either relatives or close enough friends that we let it go and took the people out. There were some 550-odd people in these freight cars. Women and children mostly, but also some men who had been left behind.
Let me ask one little question here while it's on my mind. What happened to the Polish and the other slave laborers at this time? Were they milling around?
They had been released, and they were milling around all over this general area, and some of them had gotten guns, and as far as we were concerned, they were a threat. Because they had wanted nothing more than to kill the Germans.
What did you do about this? The American troops protect the Germans?
No, in general, the Poles were, and the DPs, displaced persons, were in the woods. They were gradually making their way home on foot. Sort of, they were eager to get home, too, I suppose. They had no transportation other than foot. We were not assigned any troops to guard this train. And we had only Williams, who was an officer, and he had a gun. Staver had, at that point, gone back to Paris for some reason that I don't remember, but Staver was not with us on that at that
point. So you were just
point.
A group of civilians, basically, and there
was, there was myself, Williams, and then this, shortly after we had gotten the train out, perhaps a couple of hours after this, Captain Huckmuth came up, bringing up the rear in a little diesel locomotive that had come from Panamunda originally. It had been a little work train, diesel. And he was a legitimate Army officer and had a gun. And I think there were only two legitimate Army people there, and only two weapons in the place.
Well, so if there had been any organization of these DPs...
Oh, they could have wiped us out.
Yeah. Did you ever talk to any of them personally?
No.
One of their leaders?
No.
They just were dispersed in the woods.
Well, the time when we had the most problem was later on when we... I have to sort of take this in continuity here, or you won't understand it. We did find from one of the German station masters shortly after we left Bleicherode that we would not be able to go to the one destination and then the other as we had intended. The two destinations were Witzenhausen and Eschwege. We were to go to Witzenhausen first. That's where the train was headed, and we expected then to take the train over to Eschwege and deliver the rest of the people. The station master told us that the bridge had been, he had heard that the bridge had been blown up between Witzenhausen and Eschwege, and the only way we could get into Eschwege was to go back through Mühlhausen. We could get to Witzenhausen all right from where we were, but we had to go by a slightly circuitous route through the hills into Eschwege. And the only thing to do was to split the train and take it in two pieces. And at that point, we did have two locomotives and about 50 or 60 cars. Colonel Williams said he would take the first part of the train then into Witzenhausen and would jeep over and meet me in Eschwege, and I would take this part of the train into Eschwege, back to Mühlhausen. And Huckmuth, then it was just about at that point that Huckmuth caught up with me, and he would come with me. And I remember just there on the siding out in the fields, divided up with what food we had been able to bring from the German stock, just dividing it arbitrarily into the two pieces of the train because we really didn't know when and how we were going to feed these people. Well, it was a long and hard ride. We got into Mühlhausen. It was, to give you some idea of the time, it was sunset by the time we got into Mühlhausen. We had started early in the morning. And Mühlhausen wasn't really all that far from Bayreuth. At that point, the engineer decoupled to get coal and water, and it was a steam locomotive. And then instead of coming back and coupling onto the train, he simply hightailed it on back on the track toward Nordhausen for reasons which I simply don't know. I don't know why he did. Maybe he decided he wanted no part of these rocket scientists. Maybe he decided he wanted to go back and get his family out of Nordhausen. I just don't know. He just disappeared to the engine.
You got this stand.
And so there we were with the cars stranded in Mühlhausen and no locomotive. So at that point, we took Huckmuth, the gun, and went in and told the station master that we urgently required another locomotive, and he better get on his communication system and find us one. And he really believed our threat and was frantically trying to find a locomotive somewhere or other. He did get in a small locomotive shortly thereafter, but it sounded bad, and the engineer said he would refuse to take it another mile. Its injector was broken, and it was going to blow up any minute. And so we couldn't use that, or decided not to use it. And then finally they got another locomotive, which was the smallest one used on the whole German system. This was about 11 or 12 o'clock at night, and pitch dark. Poles all around in the woods, thinking that they should be riding on these trains instead of the Germans. I didn't negotiate with them. There was nothing to negotiate with the Poles. We weren't going to take them, and there was no point in talking with them. Even. And then we got this one locomotive and found that it wouldn't pull more than about 10 cars at a time up the hill outside town. It wasn't powerful enough. And so we decided, well, we'll break this. We had about 30 cars. Let's break them in three batches of 10 and pull them up 10 at a time. Either pull or push them up at a time. First idea was to pull them. And then we discovered that not a single one of these cars had any kind of brakes. Had hand brakes on them. And if they were air brakes, but if you decouple them from... If the coupling broke, there was no way under God's earth to keep the thing from rolling right on back down the mountain and off the side. So it would be certain death for the people in that car and all the cars behind it if the coupling broke. So we said, well, let's push them up. And then we discovered that there was no way in God's earth in which you could shuffle these things around in the yards at Mühlhausen in such a way as to get that locomotive in between two sections of this.
Oh, yeah.
This group of cars we had. No way to get it in there. So it was either pull them up and take the chance or sit there until morning and we could maybe get some other kind of a locomotive. And I had to make the decision what we should do. And finally I decided that we would take the chance. And then I decided I would ride up on the last car of the first group of 10. So that if at least the first time we tried it didn't work, I wouldn't have to be around to explain why I made the decision that way. So I crawled in the last car, and I remember it was pitch dark, of course. I had a flashlight, but I wasn't using it, and I heard an absolute Brooklyn voice swearing gently in the dark in English, in Brooklyn English. I turned the flashlight on him and discovered it was indeed a Brooklyner who had gone over to visit his father and gotten pressed into the army and managed to get himself assigned to Peenemünde and therefore had somehow or other managed to get on the train.
He was in the German army in the war?
Yeah, he was pressed into the German army because he got caught there at the beginning of the war.
He's an American.
American, absolute American. With a Brooklyn accent you wouldn't mistake anyway.
Oh,
So that provided enough amusement for me to...
What did happen to him?
I have no idea. I think he got put into one of the groups. Probably wasn't chosen to come over to the States.
Uh-huh.
And Well, in any case, we had to do this when we got to the top of the hill with the first section. Then the question was, we had to do some switching there to get the locomotive back around, back down to the bottom. There was no signaling, no automatic signals on that stretch of track. And the way they worked it generally was for the switchman at the top to telephone down to the bottom, there was a telephone to try to keep anything from coming through. And we couldn't work the switches or work the telephones without getting into the switch house and breaking some locks and things of this sort. I was all for breaking them and trying to operate them, but the trainman said, no, let's not do that. We don't want to break that. We know where the switchman lives. He's just down the road here in Long Beach. Come down with us and we'll get him out of bed and get him up here to work the switches. It turned out he was quite a long way down the road, but I ended up then about 3 o'clock in the morning walking down the road with these two German trainmen, pitch dark in a strange uniform. And along came a jeep full of military police who wanted to know what the hell we were doing out during the curfew. Oh. So I did the best salesmanship I think I ever did in my life on these boys, and managed not only to get him to provide his transportation to quickly get the switchman and get him up and do his stuff, but also to give us a carload of K rations. Again, at least try to feed the train crew. I was afraid if I didn't get some food for these trainmen, I'd lose them too. So we did this, and we shuttled, and we finally got the thing into Witzenhausen, and Williams was there. And he had gotten, we got the train into Eschwege.
Right.
And Williams had gotten his group into Witzenhausen and was there at Eschwege to meet me. And so I went to bed for about 48 hours and tried to catch up on sleep. After a while, we then did try to straighten things out. There were a lot of incidentals, such as the military commander in Eschwege was an absolute American guy, and in fact he had been a GE accountant in his earlier, before he got into the army, I understood, but he was absolutely no good as a military commander and was mostly interested in social life, and he simply didn't make any provision for getting these people off the train. So there they were sitting in the station in the town, and just a faucet and one toilet in the railroad station, and only what food they brought with them. And we had to do something about it, so finally Williams, I guess, went to this guy's superior, and the superior sent back a note saying the people will be off the trains by tonight. And so the guy was mad about it having been gone over his head, and he asked the burgomaster for a list of the houses in the town, and me for a list of the people on the train, and assigned one name, one house, making no provision for the fact that one name might be another and the other a six-month-old child. The houses might be across town. None of them had any ration cards. So there was a great deal of this kind of just plain dirty work that was necessary in order to get places for these people to stay, food for them to eat, and general living accommodations. In Witzenhausen, it was quite different. The military commander there was excellent, and he had a good relationship with the burgomaster, and one thing he did was to get a great big house and put most of them in it. And von Braun was there, and most of them were there where they could all be together, and the rest of them that had to be in other places were close by, and it was a good arrangement, and it was quickly done. And after we got that house cleaned out and people settled down a little bit, we then sat down to see what should we do about bringing the people to the States. Now, while that was all going on, I should tell this other story about the five boxes. Just before we pulled out of Blaschewode, on the walking along the siding beside the train with the people already in the cars, Colonel Axter gave me five pieces of paper, and he said, these are descriptions of the places where each of the five members of Dornberger's staff buried one box of documents, which were considered to be the most important papers that Dornberger had.
These are documents that have come down from Peenemunde.
Or Peenemunde, or from Berlin, or from other sources. Yeah,
he had
brought them from Peenemunde to Nordhausen, and they were in his office at Nordhausen. And most everything else had either been destroyed or buried, but these were considered to be most critical. And one member of the staff, but as he discharged his staff and told them to go off. And, he asked them each to do one last task and take this box and
bury
the box and tell him where. And Axter, as chief of staff, had these five typewritten slips of paper which told him where they were buried. And most of them were fairly clear descriptions, and they had map coordinates on the detail on German maps. And he said, well, you must pick up these papers. They're the most important things that you could possibly get. And at the moment, I wasn't about to let anything distract me from getting those people out before the Russians came in. And I really didn't have any idea that there would be any opportunity whatever to go after the boxes. So I stuffed them in my pocket. But after we got cleared out, and I found them in my pocket again, and asked Axter if he'd really been serious about this. And he said, oh, yes, absolutely, you ought to go in there. And I made a check and found the Russians still hadn't moved in force into the Nordhausen area. So I did get one German and went back myself.
A short trip back.
I just went. Oh, it must have been 4 or 5 days after the trains had gone out. And I thought I would make it as inconspicuous as possible. And if I got caught, well, I got caught. But there didn't seem to be any real danger. And so we went in. We did not have the maps on which the coordinates were specified. But I picked the one that seemed clearest, and I thought I might be able to find that without the coordinates. Went through the whole routine.
Why didn't you have the maps?
They were special German maps, and I just didn't...
You had to stick with the paper.
In Witzenhausen, we didn't have a thing, you see. In the way of map files or so on. But I had the slips of paper, and they had descriptions, and I thought I could find it. And this one, the last item on the... on the treasure hunt instructions were that the box was buried at the base of a pine tree broken over at 1 meter height. I found this particular forest, and I knew I was in the right general area, but there were hundreds of pine trees broken over at 1 meter height or approximately, and I probed and stayed as long as I thought I dared, but couldn't find it. I went back to Witzenhausen that night, and accused Axter of playing games with me, but he swore up and down that the boxes were there and they were important and I ought to find them. So I then went to Kassel to see if I could get the maps. I went to a railway engineering unit, which I figured would have the maps, and they did. But I also found a CO there that had a bunch of troops that were bored and getting into trouble, and he desperately wanted something for them to do. He said, how would you like me to go in and get the boxes for you? Mm-hmm. I said, that's great. So he organized five separate expeditions with mine detectors and maps and weapons, if necessary, to fight their way out, and the works. And we sent a German, sent them into German with at least one or two with each of these expeditions, and they all went in, and in one day found the boxes and brought them back.
These were very, very important boxes.
They were indeed important boxes. When I saw the stuff, I could see why Axter had taken the reaction he had. Well, let me tell you what some of them were. They were all of the German atomic energy documents, for example, Heisenberg's special reports and things of this sort, which Dornberger had been privy to because of his position on one of the advisory councils.
Okay.
Of this. Also, the latest... I think it was dated February 1945, instruction book for the handling of the V-2, which was invaluable to us, and many other things of this sort. It was indeed a secret and top-secret collection of important stuff. When I saw it, I decided that I had to be very careful to be sure that it did indeed get back through ordnance channels and wasn't commandeered off me by somebody with higher rank and shape. Now, at this point, I was working under Army orders, not CIOS instructions.
You had the two hats, so you could take one off.
And, well, the minute I left the Garmisch-Partenkirchen area, I was off CIOS. I had left my CIOS assignment and was now on an Army ordnance, Army orders. And so I was, therefore, able to pack up these five boxes in a three-quarter ton truck and drive it myself to Paris. I drove it myself to Paris and put it in the Army Ordnance Depot there. And I later...
Who took command of it over there?
The CO of the Army Ordnance group there, who operated the depot. I then had a chance to go through it in some detail there, and I finally separated out about 50 pounds of what I considered to be the most critical thing that somebody in the United States should see and quick. And I was just about finishing my assignment there at that point, and I carried that particular package back to Washington on my own back.
You put
to London, yeah. Mm-hmm.
To London. You brought it right into the Pentagon.
Yeah.
Who did you give it to?
Talk to
it. Talk to himself.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to...
Okay. Continuing the discussion with Dr. Porter on May 20th. It was in the late summer or early fall of 1944, while the war was still going on, that Colonel Trischel came to... had a conference with some of the top people there. I know that only that Harry Winnie, who was then Vice President of Engineering, and W.D. Coolidge, who was then Vice President of Research, were involved in those discussions.
Are they still available?
Coolidge is still in Schenectady. Has been retired for many, many years. His health is now finally beginning to fail. He's in his 90s.
Hmm.
Winnie, I believe, is dead. In any case, Trischel apparently asked that General Electric undertake some sort of broad research and development activity in the general area of rocket missiles, rocket-propelled missile systems, including guidance and control and aerodynamic structures, propulsion, the works. As to why he came to General Electric, I can only guess that he... wanted to get a large, diversified company that had considerable background in research and development. At that point in time, General Electric was the first company in the United States actively working on jet engines. We had no rocket experience and hadn't even thought about rocket work. None of us had had any background whatever.
Had you had any personal interest in it yourself? Did you follow Goddard? Or?
Well, I knew about Goddard's work, of course, and had always found it very interesting. And one of the first things I did... let me just back up a minute as to how I got into the thing myself. I was at that time, personally, working as the head of the R&D activity on aircraft equipment. This included the whole aircraft armament system, autopilot work, what we would now consider to be avionics in general. I had then gotten very much interested in the whole field of radar, and that's a whole other story. I had built the first automatic tracking equipment for radar as a contractor to a radiation laboratory. At MIT, and had been designing and doing the development designs of aircraft radar, aircraft armament systems, turrets, autopilots, camera controls, anything that really could be considered to be fighting war. when Winnie and Coolidge were looking around for somebody to head this project, they had to take into consideration, I guess, both ability and availability. It would have been logical, certainly, to take somebody out of the jet engine activity. But at that point in time, the jet engine development work was essentially in trouble. They needed to get designs done and very fast in order to keep up with production contracts, and so that there just wasn't anybody that could be spared from the jet engine development activity. I could be spared from what I'd been doing on aircraft equipment, and apparently they thought I was able to do the work. Frankly, I was scared to death of it, and I remember as I went down to the train with Colonel Trochel after we'd agreed to take it on, and he was going back to Washington, I mentioned to him that I really was frightened of the assignment. I didn't think I really had the capability and didn't know how I was going to do it. And his comment was, well, you do it just like you eat an elephant, he said, one bite at a time. So I was heartened by that, and we did try to go after the job one bite at a time.
With your team?
I then had to select a team, and again I had to select people that were available, but I tried to get the range of capabilities that I thought I would need, and clearly rocket technology was one thing we didn't have. Supersonic aerodynamics was another thing we didn't have, and we did have a good deal of electronics technology, but it needed to be of an advanced kind, clearly. So I did pick Dr. Lipovsky because he was a first-class physical chemist, and I thought he would understand the combustion and fuels problems as well or better than anybody else, certainly from a theoretical point of view. Ed Hull was a mechanical engineer of very high caliber in the research and development laboratory. He was an expert in friction problems, in impact problems, and generally far-out mechanical research work. I thought that he would be a very good addition in the rocket engine design activity with Lipovsky's theoretical work. We also picked up an explosives chemist of long experience by the name of Art Winslow, W-I-N-S-L-O-W.
That name was
known on the list. He did not go to Europe with us. But Winslow was the kind of a guy that could be depended upon to work with dangerous and powerful chemical combinations without anybody's being killed. That's what I particularly
wanted.
He stayed behind to work on the design of the Malta test station. Sort of as my second in command, I picked another name that is not on your list, and that's Arthur Robinson. Robinson had been working on a variety of things. He had been in charge of our aircraft magneto work. We were one of the big suppliers of modern types of magnetos, including some RF ignition systems. Let's call them ignition systems rather than magnetos, because they were quite different from ordinary aircraft engine magnetos. He had also worked on some other things for me. He had worked under me in this aircraft equipment development activity, and I felt he was the kind of guy I could depend on as an assistant team leader. He was the one I left behind to keep things going while I went over to Europe. So he and Winslow were the two basically concerned with the design and initiation of construction of the Malta test station and the other work that had to be done while we were away. I picked Dr. R. Hosmer Norris for the aerodynamics activity. He was primarily a fluid dynamics and heat transfer specialist. And I thought that rather than take a regular subsonic airplane aerodynamicist for the kind of work that we would be doing, we would better start right off in the supersonic regime and get somebody who had experience in supersonic fluid mechanics, and Norris was that man. He was very capable. Walt House was then active in the very young, essentially just being born, electronics laboratory in Syracuse, a very broad gauge electronics man with competence in radio, radar, and other radio frequency type electronics. These were the people I was able to get first of all. Another one that came with us very shortly thereafter was John Moore, who had worked with me on computers, airborne computers for radio, for radar and optical armament systems for aircraft. And Moore became our top celestial mechanics or exterior ballistics man. Moore later left the project to get his PhD at George Washington University, I think, in St. Louis. It was in St. Louis, in any case.
Washington
University in St. Louis. And then went on with North American, and later became a vice president of North American, and I guess is now with McDonnell Douglas. Very capable man. So we were picking up competent people, although we did not have access, generally speaking, to people who had experience. There just weren't enough of them around the company. I'm sure that the idea that Ordnance had in giving us the contract was to develop people rather than to take the few that were already available. We were instructed to work closely with Caltech, which was the only other active organization in this area at the moment, and with more experience than we had. And I finally decided that we really should have a man permanently out there to act as liaison with them. And for reasons that are too complicated to go into on a short tape, I was able to get Dr. Cy Ramo, who was then in our research laboratory, working on radio work at the time, along with John Winery, to join our project and go out to be in residence at Caltech. I needed somebody with great prestige, of course, to deal with the Caltech people, and Ramo had it, and was interested in, for personal reasons at that time, in going back to California, and undertook the assignment and did it for several years. However, it was not just something we did for Ramo. After Ramo decided that he was going to have to stay in California permanently, this was clearly not a big enough job for him, and we then did later replace him with another individual who, it doesn't matter. Johnny Helbeck, I think, was his successor. But we did, I mention this only to show that we did try to maintain the very best of and closest of relations with Caltech. So that we were not competing with them and not duplicating what they were doing, but rather trying to make four ordnance cooperative and coherent pair of projects.
Okay, well, then I guess we can, where do we go from here? You got back to yesterday to your 50 pounds on your back. Yeah. Turn it over to talk to us.
Well, I guess the next thing, I've forgotten whether we mentioned in detail yesterday, but after we had Von Braun and his people successfully located in, that is, in houses anyway, in Witzenhausen and Eschwege, we then settled down to the question of trying to decide who should come to the United States and for what. So we had fairly long, extensive meetings in Witzenhausen, bringing the necessary people from Eschwege, of Von Braun and his team, his top leaders. And at that point in time, they decided, at least tentatively, that they wanted to go on working on the two-dimensional ramjet or ramjet wing type of long-range ballistic missile. And I was at that point in time able to communicate reasonably well with Washington, and there was some reason to believe that Toptoy and Simons would go along with it.
Did Toptoy come to Europe at all?
Not yet. He did come later. At that point in time, he was still back in Washington. So having decided that they wanted to work on that kind of a project, we then sat down to see who should come. The initial concept was that we would try to bring a complete, essentially a complete team, including at least the foreman level, shop people, draftsmen, procurement people, a team that could be essentially autonomous, picking up only perhaps some lower level shop people in the United States, and they would be able to run on their own without any help from anybody. In order to try to implement that kind of a program, von Braun originally proposed, I think, a list of something like 500 people. And I was very much impressed with von Braun at that point, because he seemed to have the capability of going down through a list of 1,000 names or more, and being able to know what most of them had done and what their capabilities were. Knowing people is the one requirement of a good manager, and he certainly had it at the time. And what he didn't have, is the people who reported to him did have. I was very satisfied that the list that they were proposing was quite good. They were not all people from Peenemünde. They did include some of the people from Stuttgart. One of them was Ted Buchel, whom I mentioned yesterday. They did pick up a few people from other places in Germany who had worked closely with them, but most of them were Peenemünde people. And they were mostly people that we either had brought out of the Nordhausen area, or who were still down at Garmisch-Partenkirchen, or who could be at least found in other places, such as Buchold and others that we who were in locations that we knew. However, I was not at all sure that anybody in the United States would sit still for bringing a group of as big as 500 people over. And so at considerable urging, von Braun and I sort of reluctantly cut the list down to about 300, which we considered to be a real bare minimum if they were going to try to operate on an autonomous basis. And at that point in time, I went to Paris with the load of documents, and for the purpose of trying to be able to get better communication with Toktoy. I also, at that point, had already been made aware that General Electric had agreed to support the Army in as part of his Hermes project in firing some V-2 rockets in the United States, and that I would have to be responsible for that. And it had been suggested by Toftoy in a telegram of some sort. In fact, I had orders from him to select 5 individuals out of the German group to help us with this V-2 firing program. This was to be quite separate from the project that the Germans were going to do on their own as an autonomous project, but simply 5 people for a while to help us learn how to fire V2s, assemble and fire V2s. I, of course, worked closely with von Braun in trying to select these people, and we tried to select people who were about 2 echelons down, people who would not be needed to organize the autonomous project, but who had very close nuts and bolts experience with the V2, and I thought we made a good selection there. So I did pick up these 5 and headed on back to Paris in my truck with the 5 people and the documents. My orders were to leave them at a place on the way that had the code name Dustbin. I can't remember at the moment exactly where it was. It was on the road generally between somewhere between Frankfurt and Paris. When I got there, I discovered, as I might have known from its name, that Dustbin was basically a British RAF facility, and was being guarded by the British, and we already knew about the British plans for Cuxhaven. So when I got to Paris, I was very eager to communicate with Toftoy on a basis that we couldn't do by telegram, at least not by open telegram, as to a lot of things. The 3 things were basically the documents I had, the fact that I was pretty sure the people that I had left at Dustbin wouldn't be there very long, they'd be spirited off to British firing program. And Where was that program? I said it a minute ago.
Cuxhaven.
Cuxhaven, yeah. They would be spirited up to Cuxhaven within a day or so. And the other thing was the size of the contingent that we wanted to bring over. So I was able to use the scrambled Telex system, which was available in Paris, and get Tuftoy on one end and myself on the other so that we could, in effect, have a direct exchange of views. I was amused with respect to the matter of the five technicians for the V-2 program, because I explained very carefully and in detail to General Colonel Ben Tuftoy why I didn't think that was a very good place to leave these people. In fact, I told him I was sure that by Monday morning they wouldn't be there. And asked him for permission, asked him for orders to put them somewhere else, to bring them to Paris or whatever. His reply was, I understand the situation, can take no action now. And I screamed as loud as I could over the tax that this was not a satisfactory answer, but didn't get any better satisfaction. I later learned from Tuftoy that the British were monitoring that complete circuit and that he didn't dare say anything except what he said. Well, he couldn't even say that. He was trying to say it the best he knew how, but I didn't get the message somehow. I was too upset. At that point, also, he felt that the 300 was an impossibly large number, and that it would have to be cut down. I asked that it be cut down to 100. I said I didn't think they could do that and run an autonomous project. And it was about that time, I think, that Tuftoy decided he better come over and give me a hand.
That was his first trip over?
Oh, I don't know that it was his first trip.
On this matter.
But that was his first trip over on this particular matter. I'm sure he had been over before during the war.
Let me ask one quick question. Trichel's relationship to Tuftoy?
I believe that Trichel was Tuftoy's superior at that point. Yeah.
That's what I never really...
Tuftoy was at that point in time gradually taking over Trichel's job. As head of R&D. Whether Tuftoy had actually taken it over at that point in time, I'm not sure. Trichel was chief of R&D.
Right.
At the time he placed the contract with us. But he was preparing to retire at that point. And he acted then, or whether it was...
In the process of it. Tuftoy did replace him.
But Tuftoy did replace him, and I think was preparing at that point in time.
Presumably deputy for a while.
Yeah, okay. To take over. So Tuftoy did come over, and then in working with Von Braun, we did cut the number down to about 100. And at that point in time, we had to make the policy change that we would not try to make it a completely autonomous operation, but would bring the scientists and engineers, and only a shop foreman if he had some peculiar skill that we were sure could not be found anywhere else. And not draftsmen, and not the procurement people, or other, or financial people, or anything of this sort. And the arrangement then was that the ordnance would contract with General Electric to supply these missing skills, on the understanding that the Germans would run their own project, and that the people who were assigned to it by GE would not be in any sense their bosses, but their servants, to do what was needed to make the German project go, because we were clearly wanting to make that an autonomous Von Braun project. It was already, I think, known at that time that they would be set up first in El Paso, as you know they were. Man whom we put in charge of that phase of the work, of supervising the GE people who were assigned to help the Germans in their autonomous project, was Al DeMont, D-E-M-O-N-T, and he is still available in Schenectady. And would remember a good deal about that phase of the work. Then that about wound up my European phase on this project, and I came home, as I think I told you last time, arriving on VJ Day. And we then did proceed to get the three activities of our work going. preparation for the B-2 firings using the hardware that Jim Hamill had gotten out of Nordhausen for the most part. We had to catalog it. We make sure we knew what we had. Hamill had got it to White Sands, I think,
all
the way.
Went down to New Orleans, Did you mention, or was it someone else? I think it was you, about this. The British tried to intercept this.
Yes, I think I did mention that it was the ships were turned around
a couple
of times.
Uh-huh.
And there was, I'm sure Hamill could give you a much more vivid description than I can.
Did the British, how closely did you work with the British around, regarding this Von Braun thing? Was it, did the British want these fellows themselves, or some of them?
I think they wanted everything they could get for the Cuxhaven.
But did they have any follow-on to Cuxhaven?
No. They didn't have any follow-on and never intended to have any follow-on.
What was the purpose, basically?
Their purpose was purely as an intelligence operation. They wanted the Germans actually to fire the V-2s while they documented exactly what they did. They thought that was the best way to